Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, for the first segment, we'll hear from activist Matt Ginsburg Jekyll, who has been involved in Honduran solidarity social movements for over two decades. He'll discuss the history of U.S.-Honduran relations, and we'll hear updates about the oppression and unrest there after last year's corrupt election. In the second segment of the program, Ursula Wolf-Rocca of Rethinking Schools and the Zen Education Project joins us to talk about the power of teaching for social change and teaching beyond the textbook. We'll hear about the importance of connecting past to presents from COINTELPRO and MLK to Black Lives Matter and more. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On the first segment of today's program, we're going to take a look at U.S.-Honduran relations. Not just a history of those relations, but there is a lot going on in Honduras. And while the corporate media in the United States is infinitely infatuated with Donald Trump's tweets and the government shutdown, there are many, many things happening around the globe of great significance, and certainly in Central America and in Honduras. So we are today fortunate to be joined by an expert on U.S.-Honduran relations. Matt Ginsburg Jekyll is a member of La Voz de los de Abajo and has been doing work in solidarity with Honduran social movements for almost two decades. He was recently in Honduras during and after the November 26th election, co-leading a human rights observation delegation. He spent years volunteering with the Civil Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, whose co-founder, Berta Cáceres, was assassinated last year and was a close friend. He's helped lead numerous delegations to Honduras, organized numerous speaking tours of Honduran activists, and translated hundreds of statements and interviews from the Honduran resistance. Matt is a translator of Honduran feminist Melissa Cardoza's 13 Colors of the Honduran Resistance, which was recently published in the U.S. in the bilingual English-Spanish version. Matt supports himself as a Spanish interpreter in a hospital, has a Master's of Arts degree in literary translation. He's also the co-founder of Southside Together Organizing for Power, STOP, in Chicago, an organization that's been fighting for over a decade for health care and housing rights on Chicago's South Side. Matt Ginsburg Jekyll, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
And a great extensive bio, and I did want to read the whole thing so our listeners can get the breadth, depth, and scope of your commitment to social justice movements, both domestically and abroad. So since today we're going to be focusing on Honduran-U.S. relations and some of the developments that are going on in Honduras, and we're going to get to the current events here by the time we're done with this segment, but why don't you give our listeners a context about U.S.-Honduran relations?
Honduras has been aptly and unfortunately known for a long time as a banana republic of sorts. It's a country whose political history traces back to the United Fruit Company and the Standard Fruit Company, who founded each of its two major political parties, or something akin to the Democrats and Republicans, and as much as they've both always responded to corporate and especially transnational interests in the country. It's a country that has also a long history of struggle against the conditions that have ensued as a result of that kind of foreign domination, as well as the consolidation in the last century of an oligarchy of really about 10 families that for the last half of last century and into the present day have really controlled almost all of the wealth in Honduras and have been very close to the United States for a long time. Maintaining the population in complete misery, I would say, is the right word to describe it. Besides Haiti, the most impoverished country in the Western Hemisphere, and that's despite having incredible mineral wealth, an incredibly hardworking population, beautiful beaches, beautiful mountainsides, and really just a rich cultural tradition. But because almost all of the wealth produced in Honduras is either siphoned off by transnational corporations or ends up in the hands of those 10 families, the population has really been maintained in this extreme level of underdevelopment, high poverty, incredible levels of inequality. And so throughout history, most Honduran governments have responded exclusively to that oligarchy and to the U.S. interests that prop it up. There was a brief period of deviation from that. It started at the beginning of this century, actually, and around 2006 when Manuel Zelaya was elected president. And he was not somebody who came out of the popular movements. He was not somebody who came out of the union movements. He was somebody who came out from the landed class of people, but who began to say, well, why do I have to take all my dictates from the 10 families that rule this country and from the U.S. Embassy? What happens if I listen to other segments of society? And he opened up the doors to listen to indigenous peoples about policy affecting them, to listen to Afro-Honduran or Garifuna peoples about the policy affecting them, to listen to landless peoples about the policy affecting them. He also began to say, why do we need to maintain ourselves in the shadow of the United States when Latin America has tons of richness and really should be ruling our own destiny? And he began to open up conversations with Venezuela, with Nicaragua, with other places about alternative types of alignment geopolitically. And then he made some initial, as a result of those conversations and realignment, some initial changes to benefit the poorest of the poor in Honduras, doubling the minimum wage, beginning to resolve some of the land claims, historically small things, but things that made a lot of difference in people's lives for folks that had not seen a lot of progress despite tremendous struggle for a long time. They were also things that were the last straw for the U.S. CIA, State Department, and their puppets amongst the oligarchy and the traditional two parties, the National Liberal Party in Honduras, who quickly began demonizing him, demonizing especially the social movements that had been pushing him in this direction. It's important to remember the social movements started out protesting him like every other regime and then encountered these spaces of dialogue and began to ally with him and with the project. And they said, you know what, President Zelaya, it's great that we're making these reforms, but we want to deepen this. We want to have a new constitution. We want to have a constitution that includes women, that includes LGBT people, that includes Black people, that includes indigenous people in it. It talks about workers' rights. And he said, okay, well, let's do an opinion poll about whether there's popular support for this constitutional referendum. The date of that opinion poll, a non-binding referendum, was to take place. A U.S.-trained general, General Romeo Vasquez Velasquez, trained at the School of the Americas in Georgia, with a wink and a nod from Hillary Clinton's State Department and the full complicity of the entire Honduran oligarchy and U.S. corporate interests in the country, carried out a coup d'etat. They broke into his house, the military did. They kidnapped him in his pajamas. They flew him first, and this often gets left out of the story, first to the U.S. military base in Honduras, the largest one in Latin America, and then on from there to Costa Rica. And what ensued, to sort of move forward a little bit, was years of brutal repression, but also years of tremendously inspiring resistance, where people continued to fight despite what the Honduran government and their U.S. backers thought would happen, which was a couple days of turmoil followed by what had always happened after coups, which was people going back about their business and things continuing as normal. Instead, in this time, people said, no, we're going to continue fighting. And it's not just about reinstating Zelaya. It's about this constitutional assembly. It's about the dreams that we have. It's about the fact that we're seeing an opening. We're seeing the beginnings of what could be progress, what could be us determining our own destiny, and not under the boot of U.S. domination, of U.S. imperialism. And we're going to keep fighting for that, no matter how many of us that you come for in the middle of the night, no matter how many of us that you've got down at the airport, like Isis Obed Murillo, the 19-year-old who was gunned down waiting for President Zelaya to try to re-arrive in the country July 5th, just after the coup. No matter how many martyrs this takes, we're going to keep pushing towards that dream.
The coup that you're referring to is 2009?
Correct.
We want to make sure that listeners are following along in the narrative. So this is nearly 10 years ago.
Correct.
And you mentioned several things to possibly unpack. Of course, the listeners of this program are familiar with the School of the Americas. We've done numerous shows, and of course, they've changed their name over the years. But this is the arm of U.S. military training that trains Central American military people to suppress dissent and to actually carry out things like coups and so forth. And we've seen this happen in Central America over and over for decades and decades. The kind of kidnapping that you talk about of Zelaya is something that we've seen in Haiti, other places. So this is a part of a pattern. This is certainly not a singling out of Honduras per se.
Exactly. It is part of a pattern, absolutely. Honduras, like its neighbors El Salvador and Nicaragua, was immersed in war in much of the 80s. Honduras was used as the launching pad for many of the counterinsurgency operations in the neighboring countries of El Salvador, Guatemala and Nicaragua in particular. And all of those operations were under the guise of both the CIA's direct involvement as well as people being trained by this, the School of Americas, now the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. So you're correct. It is absolutely a pattern. Now, Honduras was, though, singled out mm-hmm. in some ways. And the reason I say that is that Honduras has been a laboratory for U.S. policy for a long time. And so what 2009 was a laboratory to see, hey, in the 21st century, can we get away with pulling off a coup d'etat? Just like before, it had been used as a laboratory for launching counterinsurgency operations. Just as later in the 80s and 90s, it was a laboratory for imposition of neoliberal policies, privatization, austerity. In 2009, it became a laboratory for how do we get away with a coup? You know, we're at a point in which the global consensus is this quote-unquote idea of liberal democracy, and so we can't make it look like a regular old military taking over. And so they didn't have the general kidnap and exile Zelaya. They had the Congress and the Supreme Court participate and quickly convene to vote and say, oh, yeah, that constitutional referendum that he was advancing was illegal, and that's why the military is defending the Constitution and carrying this out. And they got away with it.
In Venezuela, in the early W. Bush administration, there was a failed coup attempt of Chavez,
correct.
Right? So again, though, you're saying it's the testing of the waters. It's seeing how much can these folks get away with, and then they have the more legitimate institutions of the society all in the hip pocket, right? The neoliberal hip pocket of the imperial United States, and then they basically make this look like it is not a coup?
Exactly. There was all this debate, and in fact, a lot of this debate took place in Washington about do we call this a military coup or not? Because if they call it a military coup, then the U.S. government had to cut off security assistance to the government. And they didn't want to do that, of course, because these are their friends that were carrying out the coup. These are their interests that are being defended by this coup. And so they had to have a way of trying to manipulate that. And you see that model was imposed in Honduras and then refined and perfected in what we saw in Paraguay and what we saw in Brazil more recently with Temer. And you see that very clearly. The other thing, you mentioned Venezuela, and that's an important piece of this context, because Honduras was considered to be a testing ground, much as the way that we talk about the Cold War having actually been very hot in certain areas where there were proxy wars that were taking place between the Soviet Union and the U.S. Similarly, Honduras became a sort of proxy war between this emerging, independent bloc of Latin American nations with Hugo Chavez, but also Lula and others, all saying, you know what, we don't need to depend on the United States. We need to have Latin America for Latin Americans. We need to make our own decisions about our own resources and stop corporate plunder. And now, of course, there were varying degrees with which the different governments in that bloc were moving in that direction. But for Honduras, which had always been U.S.-dominated, which had been that banana republic that I talked to, which had been this bastion of CIA and corporate influence, to move in a leftward direction and join that bloc was considered this point at which a stand had to be taken by empire. And so they made an example out of it. That's exactly what happened in 2009. They made an example of Honduras. The people's movements, though, also made an example of dignity and rebellion in the face of that kind of imposition. And they launched a resistance movement that has not gone away until the present day. It fought in the streets. It fought in the mountains. It fought in the workplaces. It was not able to reverse the coup immediately, but there was heroic actions taking place. Just to mention one of them, a woman by the name of Berta Cáceres, a prominent indigenous leader and close friend, along with a woman named Miriam Miranda, who was the head of the Fraternal Black Organization of Honduras, organized black and indigenous peoples to jointly cross the entirety of the country to try to greet Zelaya at the Nicaraguan border and accompany him back into the country to retake the capital. Their buses were decommissioned, their tires deflated, chased into the mountains by the military, and they crossed the rest of the country on foot to do that. That's just one of thousands of inspiring and incredible examples of what took place and what can take place when a people is convinced that they are going to get their liberation achieved by any means. Now, as I said, they weren't successful in turning back the coup. The regime consolidated itself. Zelaya was lured into negotiations in Costa Rica, and I won't go into all the details, but the basic right. outline of it is that Hillary Clinton's State Department under Barack Obama's president, because it's important to remember, it's both the Democrats and the Republicans.
Uh-huh. That's a crucial point to remember, especially when we're talking about foreign policy in Latin America, around the world for that matter. But it's important to remember the role of Hillary Clinton's State Department. So, Matt Ginsburg, Jekyll, we'll get much more into resistance and repression. But what about the 2013 election and the corruption scandal that went on there?
what happened was that the resistance, a large part of it, created a new political party called Libre, the Freedom and Refoundation Party. And they ran Mel Zelaya's wife, Xiomara Castro de Zelaya, as their presidential candidate and had overwhelming support, especially amongst the peasant population, the worker population. And you got to remember, Honduras is over 60% peasantry. So it was clear that she was headed towards a victory. There was a third player in the room, which was Salvador Najrala, a radio announcer who was running an anti-corruption platform, which took away some of the vote. But nonetheless, she was headed towards a clear victory. However, the National Party paid off, as they tend to do. That's the way they work. They paid off thousands and millions of people to vote for them. They intimidated folks at the polls, and they stuffed ballot boxes. They were caught in numerous cases. One of the most scandalous things, though, that shrouds that 2013 election is information that came to light a little bit later, which is that there had been, leading up to that election, a corruption scandal of proportions that are almost unfathomable taking place, where pharmaceutical companies, sham companies, were selling medicines, many of which were not actual medicines. They were flour pills, pills with our cooking flour inside of them, to the public hospital system at prices that were up to 100% higher than the normal price, and then pocketing that difference and funneling it directly into the campaign of the ruling party candidate, Juan Orlando Hernandez. Thousands of people died as a result of that, getting pills that they needed and ending up not having any effect from them and dying as a direct result. And that came to light about a year after that sham election, which unfortunately was not able to generate the kind of attention that this more recent sham election has. But it did generate, once that came to light, huge backlash. And what happened was something very interesting.
Matt Ginsburg, Jekyll, just pause right there for a moment. We have to take a brief break. And I wanted to remind listeners that you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Matt Ginsburg, Jekyll, talking about the history of U.S. and Honduran relations in the early 21st century. And we're going to be getting up to the present and present election and some things that are happening. And Matt, please continue after this break with where we were leaving off. So please stay tuned. We'll be back with Matt Ginsburg, Jekyll. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program, we're looking at U.S.-Honduran relations and sort of a brief history of what's happening in Honduras in the 21st century. Matt Ginsburg Jekyll is a member of La Voz de los de Abajo, and he is also involved with Honduran Solidarity social movements, has been involved there for several decades, actually was in Honduras not long ago. And Matt, before the break, you were just getting into talking to us about the things that were happening after the amazing corruption of the 2013 election. So please continue.
That corruption scandal, where they literally plundered millions of dollars directly from the public health system that goes directly to the most needy people in Honduras and funneled it into the campaign coffers of one of the most corrupt presidents Honduras has ever known, that Latin America has ever known. It added a whole new segment of people to this resistance movement that I've been talking about. It added middle class. It added even more teachers, added even more business people, people who might not have been with the entirety of the political project of the resistance that was about breaking U.S. hegemony in the region, that was about talking about alternative economic systems and about land for those who work it and workers having control over their workplaces, but that they weren't willing to sit by idly and watch millions of dollars be plundered from their tax dollars, from their public health system, for a guy who had earned the ire of pretty much the whole country. And so we saw the seeds planted there. There was a movement that erupted called the Indignados, or the Outraged, essentially is how it would translate, And we saw the seeds planted for what became the Opposition Alliance Against the Dictatorship. So the anti-corruption party that I made brief reference to, of Salvador Najrala, a sportscaster, someone without a political background, but very much represented this more middle-class segment of people that were outraged by corruption, began to have conversations with Mel Zelaya, with the Libre Party, with other sectors of the resistance, and with many of the other small third parties in Honduras about the need to do anything necessary to stop Juan Orlando Hernandez from consolidating what was becoming a dictatorship. And let me tell you why they saw it that way and why I see it that way. Juan Orlando purged several members of the Supreme Court and replaced them with very close personal friends and political allies. He did that using his power in the Congress and raising false charges against the former Supreme Court justices who were not on his side around particularly the question of re-election, which is expressly prohibited in the Honduran Constitution. He took control of the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, putting a close ally and former congressman from his party, David Matamoros, in charge of the Supreme Electoral Tribunal. He basically took charge of all branches of government, and then to make sure that he had a way of defending his power consolidation, created a military police force, the Policía Militar de Orden Público, the military police for order, public order. They're dressed in fatigues with their faces covered. They look like Marines going into a battle in the mountainside, except they have the powers and the reach of a day-to-day police force. They patrol the neighborhoods, etc. And so people recognized this consolidation of power, recognized its danger, recognized his level of corruption. There was already, at this point, without getting into too much detail, the beginnings of the Cachiros trial, a trial against one of the major narco-trafficking organizations within Honduras. So it has come to light, have connections to his family members, his brother, for example. So people recognize we need to unify, we need to get this guy out. He's a crook. He's willing to stop at nothing to consolidate his power, and he's doing the bidding of U.S. corporate interests in the country. And so Najrala, Zelaya, the rest of these parties came together, formed the Opposition Alliance Against the Dictatorship. And this was their theory. Their theory was, if the National Party is going to steal elections, they're going to pay people to vote, they're going to stuff ballot boxes, they're going to do what they always do. And by doing that, they can probably swing about 20% support for them into about 40% support, 45%, and maybe make it look like they've won. If we have a broad enough coalition against them, we can get 80% of the vote, and not the dirtiest of their tactics will be able to completely erase that overwhelming victory.
Let's take us up to the election of last November, and what do we see happening here? Let's get up to the election, but more importantly, perhaps, since the election, what's going on? You've just set up this narrative of potential hope and resistance, and what happens then in the election is that it's incredibly corrupt. And so tell us more.
The strategy worked. The resistance won at the polls. The Opposition Alliance, they put Salvador Najrala as the candidate so that they could make sure to count on all of the anti-corruption sentiment. They mobilized all sectors of society, and they won so overwhelmingly that the Supreme Electoral Tribunal didn't know what to do. The Opposition Alliance, with the majority of the votes counted, with what was considered by the Organization of American States and other electoral observers that were there to be an irreversible tendency, quote-unquote, irreversible tendency, called up Juan Orlando Hernandez, had a conversation, and he told them, stop counting. He said, I'm losing, so stop counting. And the vote counting shut down. For days, there were no more results released. For those days, I was in the country for these days. People were celebrating in the streets. People had realized we just defeated a dictator. Despite everything he's done, we are up 5% in an irreversible lead. And then when they resumed the counting 3 days later, magically, all of the remaining 15% of the vote that was counted all broke for Juan Orlando, surprise, surprise. And he took a slight lead and eventually was pronounced to be the winner. People were outraged. They took to the streets around, and they've been in the streets ever since. It's been over a month now. The difference between this and the coup of 2009 is that Juan Orlando's military police force is openly, unabashedly, and terroristically opening fire on the population in the streets at these protests. There's almost 40 people that have been killed. I saw it myself. I was positioned for several of those days right after the elections at the public hospitals. In 1 hour that I was there, I counted 23 people that came in shot by live ammunition by the military police for the simple fact of, without arms, standing up, taking streets, blocking traffic. And yet people are undeterred, continuing the fight, and they're saying they are not going to allow him to get inaugurated. And there's a general strike that we're in the midst of right now. People are continuing to block every road, block every port, block every workplace, and say, we're not going to stop, we're going to shut it down until this man gets out. What's holding him up? What's the only thing holding him up? The fact that the United States continues to send money to his murderous army, to his murderous military police. The fact that the charge of affairs, Heidi Fulton, continues to say that these were legitimate elections, despite even the Organization of American States, even the European Union, saying that they can't stand by these results. These are not radical organizations. These are organizations that are usually following the lead of U.S. policy, and even they are so scandalized.
And they are falling out of line. And Matt Ginsburg-Jekyll, given, you know, obviously how much you are involved in monitoring and seeing what's going on in Honduras, remind our listeners how little of this is in the U.S. press.
The moment that I arrived back in the country, about 6 days after this election, having just come from a literal war zone that's bought and paid for by our tax dollars, and realized that almost none of the papers, almost nobody, even activists I know, was aware that this was going on, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, but it's also intentional. It's very intentional, because here in Chicago, for example, they close 6 mental health clinics, and they come to us and they tell us they don't have the money for those things. That's why they have to close them. Can you imagine the public's reaction if everybody knew that while they're closing those mental health clinics over $2 million, they're sending $100 million to literally murder people like my friend Berta Cáceres, who was gunned down, assassinated in her home in 2016. But a person who did not die, she multiplied, because right now as those people are in the streets, taking the streets, fighting back against this U.S.-funded repression and fraud, you see Berta's name lifted up everywhere. You see the names of all of the murders, the hundreds of struggles lifted up everywhere. And it's our responsibility in the U.S. to pay attention, to get the word out about what's going on, and to call our Congress people principally, because there is a law, an act that we're trying to pass called the Berta Cáceres Act for Human Rights in Honduras that says something that's just common sense. We shouldn't be using our tax dollars for death. We need to cut off security aid, cut off military and police aid to Honduras as long as these egregious crimes against humanity continue.
Well, Matt Ginsburg-Jekyll, can you give our listeners a website or a couple of places where they can go and not only follow your work, but also keep tabs on this? I mean, this isn't going to be on CNN. And even if it is in the Times or the Post or what have you, it's going to have a really neoliberal, pro-U.S. spin. Where can people go to find out what's going on in Honduras?
We maintain a page called HondurasResists.blogspot.com. We have direct translations, so you don't have to have it filtered through anyone else. You have the direct voices of the people in the resistance in Honduras. We report regularly there and share footage. You can follow us on Facebook, La Voz de los de Abajo. And there are some media outlets that have done decent reporting. Democracy Now! Has done some good work on Honduras. The Guardian has had a few good pieces on Honduras. And there's some good organizations that have regular updates on their websites. The Alliance for Global Justice, the School of America's Watch, Witness for Peace, to name a few. Also, all of us, all of the groups that are paying attention and accompanying the Honduran social movements, we're part of what's called the Honduras Solidarity Network. If you Google Honduras Solidarity Network, our page has regular on-the-ground updates all the time.
Well, Matt Ginsburg-Jekyll, I appreciate you coming on the program and taking time to update us on what's happening in Honduras. And, of course, also special thanks to Michael Bass, School of the Americas Watch, who helped connect us today. So we hope to have you on the show later on. And I understand there's a contingent of people that are leaving here, human rights activists, religious leaders from across the U.S. leaving for Honduras, including a San Francisco Bay Area contingent. So hopefully we'll hear from people once this continues. And Matt Ginsburg-Jekyll, thanks again for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you very much for making time for this important topic.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Stay tuned to the program. Next, we'll talk about the Zen Education Project, Rethinking Schools, and we'll even hear an instructor and a teacher talk about some lessons about COINTELPRO, Martin Luther King Jr., and the ongoing efforts to repress people right here at home. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're going to focus on education, and not just any kind of education, specifically public education, but we're also looking at the radical roots and nature of education for transformative social change, and how significant education has been historically in social justice movements. We are joined by Ursula Wolf Rocca. She's taught high school in public schools the last 18 years, currently teaching at Lake Oswego, a suburb of Portland, Oregon. She is a frequent contributor to Rethinking Schools magazine, and I know has also been affiliated with the Zinn Education Project. That's named after Howard Zinn, the late great historian, who also was a judge for Project Censored once upon a time. So, Ursula Wolf Rocca, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you.
So, just tell us a little bit about what's Rethinking Schools about, and tell us a little bit about your connection to Rethinking Schools. Feel free to tell our listeners a little bit about Zinn Education Project, and then let's talk about some timely things that are going on and some things that you've been publishing lately.
Okay. So, Rethinking Schools is a social justice education organization that was founded over 30 years ago now, and my involvement really comes through the sort of local chapter here in Portland, but also through its magazine, which has been, since I started teaching, a major source of information and insight regarding education. And what sort of sets it apart is that it deals both with politics of education, so you can find articles helping unpack sort of why charter schools make our public education system more unjust, but you can also find curriculum articles like the ones that I write, which are sort of what you might teach in a classroom to encourage students to know their world better and to engage with it as activists trying to make a better world. So that's Rethinking Schools. And then Zinn Education Project is a sort of baby of Rethinking Schools and another organization, Teaching for Change. And as you would guess from the name Howard Zinn, it's really focused on, at this point, the teaching of American history. And so it's really a warehouse of curriculum and resources for teachers who are trying to teach outside the textbook. One of the premises of a lot of the work that I do for Rethinking Schools is that the textbooks don't cut it. And a lot of teachers are, in fact, still told that they have to teach chapters out of the textbook or believe that they have to.
Ursula, there's some schools, of course, some districts around the United States where people have a hard time getting textbooks.
That's true as well. And so in some cases, you're teaching out of old textbooks, which is a whole other issue, or photocopied textbooks. And of course, we could have a whole conversation about textbooks. There's a lot that isn't in the textbooks. And what Rethinking Schools and Zinn try to do is provide teachers tools to begin teaching outside the textbook, but also some thoughts about how they might do it in their own classrooms themselves.
Ursula, we're going to have a wonderful conversation because, of course, I'm a history professor, social science professor, and focus a lot. I use Zinn's textbook. We use James Lowen's work. We use Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick's work. We use a lot of these resources that, as you say, are teaching outside the textbook, beyond the textbook. And, of course, at Project Censored, we work on the news that doesn't make the news. So the connection between the significance of a free press and what it's supposed to do is very deeply connected to the importance of public education and doing it in this kind of way. Our listeners, by the way, if you want to check out these sites as we go along, you can go to rethinkingschools.org. You can also go to zinnedproject.org, and you can learn more about these organizations there. So, Ursula, you said you write lesson plans, curriculum development that's outside of the textbook, and these are things that teachers all over can go, and they can go to these websites, and they can incorporate these things. And it's especially great resource for new teachers, people that may be struggling to try to keep up with the busy, hectic load of being a new teacher, particularly in the K-12 area and high school levels. It can be very overwhelming, very taxing, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things, this is sort of a side note for teachers out there who are listening. I mean, those of us who are in the profession know that there's a lot of people peddling their wares and for profit, and the wares are usually not very good. So there's a million sites now that are going to provide canned curriculum that you can buy, that for good reasons, teachers are exhausted and overworked and are needing help putting together their lessons. But the wonderful thing about Zinn is that everything on the website is available for free. So it really is a magical place for teachers to go and to find resources to supplement the ones they already have or to introduce things they've never thought about teaching before.
And so even for seasoned teachers, people that are maybe looking to spice things up or people that maybe have had a shift in philosophy regarding their teaching and they feel that it's very significant now, that it's important that we connect the past to the present, and that sometimes people may wonder, well, how exactly do I do that, or is there a right way? And of course, there are many, many, many ways to do that. But again, one of the great things about Rethinking Schools and Education Project, and certainly the work that you're doing, Ursula Wolf-Rocca, you kind of lay out what you do. So why don't we use an example, a very current example of something that you've published at RethinkingSchools.org, and also not long ago you published, and you've of course published something even more recently in the new issue on imperialism. But I wanted to touch on this piece first because it connects to Martin Luther King Jr., and of course we just did Martin Luther King Day in January. You did a piece on COINTELPRO, or the FBI's counterintelligence program, teaching the FBI's war on the Black freedom movement. And that is so incredibly germane to the things that we see happening in the past several years with the rise of Black Lives Matter. So, Ursula, tell us about this.
Well, you started off talking about the Martin Luther King holiday, and this lesson is one that one of my central goals, in fact, in putting this lesson together was to help restore the radicalism of King. You know, the movement, as it's taught in textbooks, is usually divided into sort of a, quote, mainstream movement, where you learn about organizations like SNCC and SCLC and CORE, and then a sort of radical movement, where you learn about the Black Panthers and maybe Malcolm X. And what COINTELPRO does is throw that artificial and inaccurate distinction between mainstream and radical sort of on its head, or turn it upside down, because, of course, the FBI's war on the civil rights movement was attacking all of those organizations, not just the so-called radical ones. And so in that whole question of King as this sort of figure we celebrate one day a year and who had a dream suddenly can't be the case, because if that's all King was, then why did the FBI see him as such a threat? And so, in fact, the whole sort of impetus for this lesson was in part that very thing, feeling that King had been neutered and that his radicalism had been stolen from him by the sort of mainstream and textbook version of his activism.
Well, indeed, and in our social media at Project Censored for MLK Day, ran down a long list of these kinds of articles, including the Zinn Education Project, and posted your piece, Why We Should Teach About the FBI's War on Civil Rights Movement. Of course, Paul Street has a great piece from 2014, Remembering the Officially Deleted Dr. King. Of course, several pieces on House Un-American Activities Committee. Alternet has a great piece on 9 MLK quotes that the corporate media don't bother to cite. The list is actually almost legion at this juncture. There's a concerted effort to just not look at the Martin King that critiqued capitalism and that critiqued imperialism and that was a staunch labor advocate. And even though King certainly had an imperfect history when it came to gender issues, there were so many intersections in King's activism that it's very convenient for the corporate media and for establishment status quo government to leave behind. And even Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting years ago did a piece about the Martin Luther King that you don't see on TV. And that's all in the spirit of what you put together in this lesson. So could you walk us through some of this and maybe just give our listeners an idea of how do you introduce this kind of a thing to your students?
For your show in particular, I think it's important to put the documents in front of the students. So the heart of the lesson is actually the documents and the documents that were stolen. And I always think, what would have happened if those documents hadn't been stolen? Because, of course, all the activists themselves knew they were being surveilled, but that wasn't sufficient proof for the rest of the country. And so there's this very dramatic and famous, now famous story. And in fact, one of the men who participated in the Media Pennsylvania theft of the FBI documents just passed away about a month ago, I think, John Rain. So these documents were stolen and then turned over to the media, and then eventually a congressional committee, the church committee, investigates And eventually these documents are available to all of us now. And so I've put together 10 to 15 of these declassified documents, and some of them are still redacted, which the students find very compelling. If you can imagine an adolescent, something's being hidden from them. They want to know why and what it is. And so the documents themselves are what I use to tell the story. And so it's a pretty actually boring teaching strategy. It's to have the kids read the documents and figure out who the FBI is targeting, what they're suggesting be done about these organizations, and then to sort of recognize what is it that these organizations have in common. What is the threat that the FBI is saying they pose?
As a fellow educator and historian, that's exactly what's so exciting about it, though, is putting those documents there. And it's so important, as you know, that when they see this, when the students see this, and they see these documents, like they see these official documents, you know, going back to 1956, where you have a picture of that Agitation Among Negroes document, right, that details an informant who was tasked to, quote, uncover all the derogatory information he could about Dr. King. In other words, they almost get a newfound respect for you, the teacher. They're saying, like, wow, you're not making this up.
Absolutely. And I think, not to take it in a different direction, but I think that kind of lesson is so important, too, as we're thinking about how to equip kids to think, if everything's going to be discredited as fake news, then how do you find your way to something that you can trust as knowledge? And so I think, first of all, teaching kids, even, which I think most adults assume that young people have an understanding of this, teach young people the government classifies things, and what does that mean, and how does that decision get made, and how do we even find out what government is doing when you have a system of classification, which seems very basic, I know, but it is actually a thorny question that students need to be grappling with.
Well, we deal with the same thing when we teach critical media literacy and connected to historiography. And really what we have, you mentioned fake news, and we could certainly dive down that rabbit hole. We've done a lot of talk about that. And we all know fake news isn't new. It's propaganda, but it's been repackaged and now weaponized to dismiss things with which people like Donald Trump or others may disagree. And it's very important, as you said, to let students, particularly young people, know that this isn't new. This is a thing. Not only does the government classify things, but corporate media routinely censor these kinds of narratives. So tell us a little bit more. You mentioned the Media Pennsylvania story, which is incredibly important, about how we find out about COINTELPRO.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why COINTELPRO is such a rich vein to mine with students, because it can go different places in different classrooms. So one of the things we often deal with in a public school setting is that we're constrained by standards that we have to prove that we have taught by the end of the year. And a lot of times that's used by teachers to sort of say, that's so great, you know, I agree with what you're doing and it's good information, but I just can't do it because I have these standards that I have to teach to. And I always say, well, you know, these meet the standards. The one thing is that the whole sort of issue of how the information gets released and then the press's role in publishing it and then the church committee's investigation, all of that could be taught in a government class where you're looking at civil liberties and civil rights and freedom of press and the importance of transparency and congressional oversight. All of those things could be taught in a government class. And then, of course, the civil rights side, the activism side, can certainly be taught in a history class.
This is ripe territory for all of these. And I know one of your colleagues, Bill Bigelow, longtime active in the same circles, has a recent piece on Common Dreams about the new film, The Post, about the Washington Post. And again, I know this has already been coming up in my classes. And we actually talked about it with journalist Kevin Gostola, who wrote a review of it. We discussed it on the last Project Censored show. But that's it, exactly. It's a lesson, it's an object lesson in censorship, in framing, in propaganda. And, you know, 40-odd years later here, nearly 50 years now, since Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, Ellsberg doesn't really, you know, have a prominent role in the film, according to Spielberg, and the focus of it is not that. The focus of it isn't really on whistleblowers. And, of course, look at the media landscape. I mean, we have a media now that when we saw Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, the corporate media, not only did they not take interest or bite or even sniff around with leaked information, they denied coverage of it, and then they attacked people that did.
There's always something that makes the discussion of COINTELPRO, the Pentagon Papers, newly relevant. You know, I said in the article that when I first started teaching 18 years ago, the early 2000s, of course, it was, I framed it in terms of the NSA surveillance scandal, which nobody's even talking about. And then there was Edward Snowden. And now, of course, we have the FBI, the leaked report this fall that they are investigating something they're calling domestic terror by something they're calling black identity extremists. It is an evergreen history. Never have trouble finding the current event which to frame COINTELPRO.
It's COINTELPRO Redux writ large. I mean, you know, you don't even have to use your imagination. When you go back through and look at some of the documents that you linked in your article, and you connect them very clearly to Sandra Bland, to Eric Garner, to the people that the Black Lives Matter movement has coalesced around, and why that it's still here, right? Why that it's here.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing that after 2008, the corporate media and pundits crowed about a post-racial America with the election of an African-American president. And then during that same period, you have the rise of one of the largest African-American civil rights movement in half a century called Black Lives Matter.
Yeah. And if I could just say a word about that, the population I teach is, I teach in one of the most affluent cities in Oregon, and my population is largely white and Asian. And I face a bunch of students at the beginning of every year that when they hear Black Lives Matter, are not in any way, you know, pumping their fists in the air. They either are ambiguous or have negative associations with Black Lives Matter. And so very explicitly, one of my goals in introducing to them COINTELPRO and, in my estimation, a more accurate understanding of the civil rights movement is to get them to see that whatever perceptions they have of Black Lives Matter certainly need to be questioned and challenged when they learn that the very organizations they now celebrate, SCLC, SNCC, King, were also referred to by the FBI in the 1960s as hate organizations. They find that word, in one of the founding documents of COINTELPRO, all of these organizations, CORE, SNCC, SCLC, they are all categorized as black nationalist hate-type organizations. And students just are outraged by that. They're like, what? That's King they're talking about. And he was nonviolent. And, you know, he was marching. And he was the guy who had a dream. Why are they referring to him as a hate-type organization? And that then creates the skepticism to help them understand, well, so what do you know about Black Lives Matter? And does it actually match up with what they're actually doing in our society? Or is that something that you, some idea that you've gotten from some other place that maybe needs to be questioned and challenged?
We're speaking with Ursula Wolf Rocca, who is a teacher at Lake Oswego High School outside of Portland, Oregon. She's involved with RethinkingSchools.org and the Zen Education Project. And we will continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're talking about rethinking schools. We're looking at the Zen Education Project, and we're hearing from Ursula Wolf Rocca, who's taken time out of her busy teaching day to talk to the Project Censored Show and share her lesson plans, her curriculum, share the research that she does, and I think most importantly, the pedagogy. How you can get young people thinking about these kind of things, about the past, in a way that brings it to life so that they begin asking questions about their own assumptions in the present. And those are certainly great hallmarks of a teacher and what I think education really looks like, especially regarding the past. And Ursula, overlapping all of this COINTELPRO stuff, COINTELPRO started as a way of allegedly routing out communists in America in the Cold War, right? And you wrote a great piece called It's Imperialism, How the Textbooks Get the Cold War Wrong. Could we use this as another example, maybe talk a little bit more? And by the way, listeners can go to rethinkingschools.org and learn more about this. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you handle this topic, which is also still very controversial, and we seem to be rekindling Cold War issues with Russia?
No kidding. This has been such a strange time to teach. Everything's getting turned on its head, you know, so the Russians are hacking us while I'm teaching students about Americans hacking other people's elections, and while I'm teaching kids about the FBI's harassment of black activist organizations, we are having the President of the United States harassing the FBI. Everything's getting turned on its head. But this piece has to do with a sort of different critique of sort of mainstream textbook history, whereas COINTELPRO is just simply not found in the vast majority of textbooks that are used in high schools. The Cold War is found, but it's found in such a way as to make it close to impossible for students to actually conceptualize. And that is because it's such a long period of time that spanned so many decades and so many different administrations that if you do a sort of march through history, chronological approach to history, you kind of miss the Cold War for the trees. That is, you read a little bit about what happened in the 50s in the chapter on Eisenhower, and then you read a little bit about what happened in the 60s on the chapter on Kennedy. And what you don't see is the whole picture of this massive, massive global intervention, the consequence of which was that we now have something like 800 U.S. military bases in every square inch of the globe. So I'm really trying to figure out a way to get kids to see the whole picture rather than this tiny piecemeal version of the Cold War.
Well, it's a really important way to teach it, and it also allows you to bring in historiographic interpretations, right? The different perspectives. Like, when you piecemeal it decade by decade, there's not a lot of dot connecting going on. And this is why students complain that they think history is boring. It turns into the one damn thing after another school,
exactly.
Right? So I teach this period very similarly to you, it sounds, in this regard. And I mean, I'm teaching, you know, intro course in modern history and, you know, colleges, community colleges outside of Berkeley, California. So, yeah. I mean, our students aren't necessarily all that different.
And I mean, I think that the key thing is that, you know, we want students to walk away with some thematic understandings that they can sort of apply across time and space. And once you kind of can do those things, you can see connections between what their textbook refers to as westward expansion and what their textbook refers to as U.S. imperialism and what their textbook refers to as the Cold War, which, of course, are all of a piece. You know, they all have to do with the theft of land. They all have to do with a belief in the superiority of U.S. power. They all have to do with desire to control resources.
And subjugation, so, you know, of minority populations.
Yeah, so I think that teaching those things in isolation is also a way of keeping students dumb, keeping them disempowered and uninformed.
That's really the crisis in the classroom, and that's what makes the difference between an impassioned teacher versus somebody that's sort of there, and some people that are just underprepared or overworked or less experienced. This is, again, a great time to plug RethinkingSchools.org, ZenEd Project, as well, as that this is a great place to help both newer teachers and seasoned ones alike that are looking to have a different approach and looking to connect the past to the present in more creative ways. And it sounds, Ursula Wolf-Rocca, it sounds like you have pretty good reception there. It sounds like that you have a good response. You have a good outcome with the students.
Absolutely. The claim that history is boring, and I am not tooting my own horn here, but is not one I hear because I don't put boring things in front of them. So as long as they are, as I said, looking at the documents that the FBI typed up on their now very antiquated typewriters with the redaction that were trying to encourage Martin Luther King to take his own life, or they're looking at the CIA declassified documents about the coup in Chile, they find that compelling, as anyone would. What they don't find compelling is a 500-page textbook that is meant to obscure more than clarify.
And whitewashes so many of the things that make history and life dynamic, important, interesting. So, Ursula Wolf Rocca, we're running out of time in the segment, but any last words you want to have on the topic and certainly connecting the importance of social justice education with all the work that you do?
Yeah, just that I guess my last thought is my hope is sort of, Ellsberg was quoted a couple days ago following the movie where he sort of said, people who are working in offices in government, if you see something, go ahead and share it, and encourage whistleblowing. And I guess that that's something I really want our students to walk away with as well, is just an understanding that so much of what we do learn about things like COINTELPRO, about things like Vietnam, comes from people who are taking matters into their own hand and making sure that people get the information that they are entitled to.
Indeed. Daniel Ellsberg called that civil courage, and certainly something that we need more of. And as historians, we know that that's the well we dig into to help people understand how we got where we are today. Ursula, thanks so much for joining the Project Censored Show. We've been speaking with Ursula Wolf Rocca, a teacher at Oswego High School, also with RethinkingSchools.org and the Zen Education Project. Special thanks too to Bill Bigelow and, of course, Deborah Mankart for helping put us together. And again, it's been a fascinating conversation, and we look forward to talking with you more and checking out more of your curricular activities online.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, executive producer and host of the Project Censored Show, along with Peter Phillips. The program began in 2010. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our engineer, Erica Bridgman. Our associate producers are Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. To learn more, listen to past broadcasts, and to support Project Censored in this program, please visit us online at projectcensored.org. You can further support the program via Patreon. Please follow and like us on Facebook and Twitter at Project Censored. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.
Political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, far for little poison, the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.